verse 51, we have come to the place where Matthew's gospel talks about the death of Jesus, and we're really on the very and we're still in that particular period or that time frame. In verse 51, then behold, the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom, and the earth quaked, and the rocks were split. A very significant earthquake, to be sure. Verse 52, and the graves were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. And coming out of the graves after his resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many. So when the centurion, so what we have kind of a, we go forward and then we come back. Now there's there has been no shortage of discussion about these verses, especially 52 and 53. Who are these people? What happened to these people? How many of these people? Well, the graves could easily be understood in an earthquake because they weren't necessarily buried in the earth. They would be in tombs. We're told that the rocks split. So we're talking about a very significant earthquake. Okay, so that part is understood. But there's a sequence here that's interesting that we need to bear in mind. Now, there's all kinds of possible scenarios here. Understand, though, Matthew records it. He does not interpret it. He does not explain it. He records it. And you need to know that. Okay. So, what is exactly going on here? The sequence, the graves are opened. But the people, their bodies are not resuscitated or resurrected until after Jesus' resurrection. Jesus is the first one, and I would argue the only one, that has been raised in a glorified body. There are other, we call them resurrections, to be a little more precise, the word resuscitation is better because those people that were raised later died again. Okay? So, in Lazarus, for example, the widow of Nain's son, Jairus' daughter, those individuals obviously died later. So they were brought back to life, but to the life that we now exist in. They were not resurrected in a glorified state like Jesus was. He is the first fruit. There is no, or has been no resurrection like his in history or in the present, but one day there will be in the future of God's people. All right? There, that's the first thing. So it could be that these who were raised, however many there were raised back to this level of existence, meaning that they would, in the future, they would die. Again, they would, their bodies would die. Yes.
They were just like Lazarus then?
They would have been, yes. Now, that's one explanation because he doesn't give us one. So you need to understand that is a possibility, but it's not a certainty. In addition to that, there is the possibility that these were raised, and after Jesus ascended into heaven, they too would have ascended. Or maybe even after his resurrection, they would have ascended into heaven. The thing that you need to bear in mind is we don't know. Matthew's the only one of the gospel writers that mentions this. And he, like I said, he mentions it. He does not interpret it, nor does he explain it. He just states it. And that after the resurrection of Jesus, they go into the holy city, Jerusalem, and they are recognized, which indicates something about these people. Number one, they're not long, haven't been long dead, because people recognized them. They knew them. So it'd be someone that would have been living at that time who had died that has been raised back to life for whatever purpose, for whatever period of time. Okay.
John the Baptist.
It doesn't say John the Baptist. It doesn't say anybody. It gives us no indication other than they go into the holy city and they are recognized. I mean, people know who they are. And it was just confirming something that miraculously took place in the resurrection of Jesus. And also in his death here. Now he deals with that, and then he comes back to where he was, and that is now to the centurion. In verse 54. So when the centurion and those with him who were guarding Jesus saw the earthquake and the things that happened, they feared greatly, saying, "Truly this was the Son of God." Okay. Now this testimony is coming from a Gentile, a Roman centurion, undoubtedly. He's the one that he sees it, others with him, and it shakes up their day to witness this. This truly was the Son of God. They didn't, and again, that's all that's stated. We don't have a whole lot of other information offered. Matthew just reporting those kind of events that took place there. He moves on. And many of the women who had followed Jesus from Galilee, ministering to him, were there looking on from afar. Among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and probably Joseph, or Josie, depending on which your Bible translates it, and the mother of Zebedee's sons. Those are the ones mentioned. There were others, undoubtedly. Now, it's easy to get the Marys confused. But what you need to kind of bear in mind, the name for the female name Mary was probably the most common female name in the first century. It may be surprising to you, but it was. Actually, it's Miriam. Anybody know an Old Testament person named Miriam?
Moses'
sister, yes. So Miriam is it's translated as Mary. There, it was a very common first century name. Last week we told you that the name Jesus or Yeshua was a very common first century name. Very common. So that too may be surprising to you, that there would have been a lot of people, a lot of men with the name Yeshua, or the Greek translation being Jesus. So they were there. They witnessed this. These women are going to be important a little bit later. All right. Comments? Questions? Yes?
Mine has in footnotes, "Truly this was the Son." It also has "for a son," small s.
Yeah.
Would the centurions, I know what probably the writer is trying to do, is say this is Jesus Christ, the Savior. But would the centurion believe that he was?
Well, actually, they're not making the profession that sometimes we think they might have made. But Matthew is affirming that they're, even though they may not fully grasp what they're saying, he's affirming that that's a correct statement.
He is.
The Romans would have been very familiar with so-called sons of God. One, both the Greek and the Roman pantheon had different demigods there that would have been called sons of God or children of God. And not only that, Caesar himself, one of his titles, would be Son of God. So they were very aware of that. They would have had that kind of background. Did they understand the Jewish Messiah? Undoubtedly, no. They would not have understood that. And really, what was the claim? What was the placard above his head? What did it read? Jesus, King of the Jews. So, the idea of, but what would took, when he died, when he yielded up his spirit, when he breathed his last, something very significant happened. And it was so significant that it scared them. And the centurion says, "This is not an ordinary man. This is not an ordinary man," because he quickly associated Jesus' death with the earthquake, which was a correct association, to be sure. Now, this is Friday afternoon. So, even though we don't have this part mentioned. We do in the other Gospels. It's mentioned that indeed they wanted bodies off of the crosses before sundown, which is going to be right around 6-ish. And they didn't want the bodies up there on the cross, because this is a very high and holy Passover season. So Joseph, we're going to read about him in just a moment, of Arimathea, is going to come and claim the body of Jesus, which we don't normally think of it this way, but it took incredible courage on his part to do that. Because when you ask for the body of a condemned man for treason, sometimes you are also considered to be a person that might be committing treason. So anyway, we'll pick up that in verse 57. Now when evening had come, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who himself had also become a disciple of Jesus. This man went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. Then Pilate commanded the body to be given to him. And it's interesting. It shows us something about Joseph. He approaches Pilate. Not the centurion who's in charge of the crucifixion team. Not him to ask for the body. He goes straight to Pilate and gets Pilate's permission to take down the body of Jesus. So he it's granted to him. So it indicates something about him. I think, if I'm not mistaken, he also was a member of the Sanhedrin. Both he and Nicodemus would have been members of the Sanhedrin, though they probably were not present during the three Jewish trials that took place the night before. When Joseph had taken the body and wrapped it in clean linen and laid it in his new tomb, which he had hewn out of the rock, and he rolled a large stone against the door of the tomb and departed. Now, a lot took place in that period of time. We understand from John's account that Nicodemus also helped him. We also found that he brought between 70 and 100 pounds of spices, and they would wrap Jesus' body and put it in the tomb. Now, here's the interesting side note about Joseph. He had a tomb, a new tomb, indicating no one has ever been placed in it before. It was the common practice of the Jews of that era was to take, they were inside of a tomb. This one's hewed out of rock, so it's not a natural cave. It is one that's been made. They'd go in and they would, in the carving of it, they would have what would look like, you call it a bed or a table or something, and next to the wall, there would be a place there where the body would be laid. The body would be laid there, and about a year later, once again, the tomb would be opened, and in case if somebody else died during that period of time, they would be laid in there too, but if not, anyway, they'd come back in, and by that time, the body's decayed, and there would be an ossuary in there. An ossuary is a bone box. So what they would do is, in that ossuary, which some of those were very expensive and very decorative, ornate in the carving in those, they would take the bones of the person that was there, put them in the bone box, and then that level, that table, as it were, or that bed, or place to lay a body, would take the next person in the family that would pass away, their body would be placed there in that same kind of process would go on. In the bone box, they'd put more than just one person. They'd do that. Now, here's the part of it that might be, I think you see the point of it, I suppose. The tomb itself would be very expensive, because you're going to hire people to do the chiseling and removal of rock, making and carving it out. Also, if you put a body in there that was not a family member, you could not use it again for your own family. So what you need to understand, was Jesus' tomb empty? Yeah, it was empty after the resurrection, and it would never have been used again. That's Jewish custom. You could not do that. You would not do that. So you can see how extravagant this particular gift would have been. Matter of fact, it fulfills the prophecy of Isaiah. He was crucified he died with the wicked, but in a rich man in his death. Isaiah chapter 53, pointing that out. So that prophecy was being fulfilled there. Okay? Questions or comments? Then comes the stone. The stone was not a big round rock, you know, like a ball. We have that kind of envisioned that way. It would have been more along the line of like a lid, you know, not very. It could have been that thick easily. And it also was carved. And it was placed kind of, the area in front of the tomb would have been on a bit of an incline right there. And there was actually a track for the stone. The stone would have been put in place, and there would be a rock there scotching it to keep it in place. Once the body of Jesus was placed in the tomb, the rock would be removed, gravity takes over, the stone would roll into place in front of the tomb. It would be large enough that it would take several men to move it. Because the tendency would be to roll it back up into place and scotch it, because it's in a track there. Now you could grab it and tip it over, but it's going to take several men to do that. It's not going to be light. A guy named Frank Morrison, an engineer, wrote a book a number of years ago, simply, Who Moved the Stone? And he applies his craft to determining how big it must have been, how heavy it could have been, how many men it would take, you know, all that kind of information. That's going to become an important factor in just a little while. Okay? So we'll move on a little bit further into the account now. So they laid his body in the new tomb, which was hewn out of the rock, and he rolled a large stone, verse 6, he says, against the door of the tomb and departed. And Mary Magdalene was there, and the other Mary sitting opposite or across from the tomb. In other words, they were there watching it being what was taking place. All right? Having been there, that dispels one of the, I guess, theories that sometimes skeptics have offered, and that is the wrong tomb theory. That the women on the first day of the week at Sunday morning, when it was still dark, went to the wrong tomb and found the wrong tomb empty. Well, not really. That's not a real possibility, because they know exactly where the tomb is. They watched it. They saw it. They were sitting there by it as Jesus' body was placed inside. So that doesn't work. The next day, which is surprising, but nevertheless, you'll see how careful, as it were, his enemies were, Jesus' enemies. On the next day, which followed the day of preparation, the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered together to Pilate, saying, Sir, we remember what while he was still alive, how that deceiver said, After 3 days I will rise. So they understood what he meant. Remember in the trial? Well, he's going to tear down the temple in 3 days, build it back. No, and they act like that was some sort of real problem. They understood what he meant. Therefore, command that the tomb be made secure until the third day, lest the disciples come by night and steal him away and say to the people, He has risen from the dead, and the last deception will be worse than the first. And Pilate said to them, You have, now I want to spend some time here. You have a guard. Go your way and make it as secure as you know how. So they went and made the tomb secure, sealing the stone and setting the guard. Now, one of the things that you probably are accustomed to seeing is around Easter time, you have a couple of guards there guarding the tomb. Now, we need to know who these people are. Are these guards, are they the temple guards under the control of the chief priests there from the temple? The temple police, is that who we're talking about? Or are we talking about some Roman soldiers? Well, I would suggest to you that the idea of it being from the temple and under the temple police, those guards, it doesn't make sense because they would not have had to went to Pilate to do this. Pilate is the one that issues the order. The order that he would have given would have been applicable to the Roman soldiers, the guards that were there. They're called a guard, and first, but then secondly, they are also, in verse 66, referred to as the guard. Now, a Roman guard was not just one or two men. If it was the full team, there would have been 16 men. And these men would have been four awake at all times. With the remaining 12, they would have been sleeping in front of the item being guarded. So what they would have done is, and we're told from the other gospel writers, Matthew doesn't include this, but the stone had a seal on it. That's what made it secure. The seal didn't seal it, but the seal was a Roman seal that would have been broken if you open the tomb. If you break the Roman seal and you're caught, your life is done. Because you have done something to violate Roman authority. So it's sealed that way. In front of it, assuming if we have the full regiment, not regiment like that, but the guard, you would have had four soldiers standing awake there by the mouth of the tomb, and then in front of the tomb, you would have had 12 others sleeping with their head toward each other in somewhat of a formation of the spokes of a tire, of a wheel. That's what they would have been doing. Even if you had a partial team, you still would have had a number of soldiers awake at all times while the others would sleep right in front of the object that they're guarding. You get the picture here. It's not one man. It's not two men. It is multiple soldiers that have given the task to guard this. Now, so a little added motivation. If they would have fallen asleep while they were on duty, the penalty was death. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. It would be death. That kind of motivates a fellow to stay awake, don't you think? And if you did fall asleep, you would never breathe a word of that to anyone, that you fell asleep. Well, after the Sabbath, chapter 28, verse 1, as the first day of the week began to dawn, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary came to see the tomb. And behold, there was a great earthquake. For an angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled back the stone from the door and sat on it. His countenance was like lightning, and his clothes as white as snow. And the guards, notice we have a plural now, and the guards shook for fear of him and became like dead men. But the angels answered and said to the women, "Do not be afraid, for I know that you seek Jesus who was crucified. He is not here, for he has risen. As he said, come and see the place where the Lord lay. And go quickly and tell his disciples that he has risen from the dead, and indeed he is going before you into Galilee, and there you will see him. Behold, I have told you." So they went out quickly from the tomb with fear and great joy and ran to bring the disciples word. Okay. And now, I mean, from here on, the verses are going to be incredibly familiar to you, knowing what took place there. So the women are on their way that early Sunday morning before dawn to go to the tomb. We also know from other details that other Gospels provide for us that they haven't thought through things really well. They're going to wanted to anoint Jesus' body more because he was so hurriedly prepared on the Friday evening before, that they were contemplating, well, how are we going to move the stone? They apparently didn't realize, or they weren't aware, that it had been sealed with a Roman seal. And they did not know about the guards being there. When they show up there, the guards are not mentioned. Because what happened there so frightened them that they became like dead men. They just froze. Maybe they passed out in fear. And when they came to, they would split as fast as they could. They abandoned their post. And that's something to add to some of the claims that you may hear from time to time, especially from a certain segment of Christianity about their interaction with angels and all this kind of thing. I've told you before, angels are scary. I mean, they're really, really, really scary. Not because they're monsters, but because they're holy. Holiness is scary. It's frightening. And when they saw this being with a several ton rock, no problem, it freaked them out. And he also, he's so bright that the description is like lightning. Matter of fact, I think it's Luke that tells us, he uses a word that indicates that the stone had actually been picked up and tossed, which was, again, remarkable when you consider it. And then there is an angel's there sitting on it and addressing the women. And the women, they have a mixture of emotion with fear and great joy. They had both of those things. That's almost like an emotional overload, isn't it? A short circuit or something with that kind of fear and great joy. It's at the same time.
Is there significance in the angel sitting on it? It always strikes me, he sits on it. I don't know exactly what purpose, but it sure does make an exclamation point to what his activity is all about.
Yeah. He's sitting there. I guess, when you sit down, your job is done. You're pretty relaxed. He's there. He's there for a very particular purpose. Yes, he took care of the stone. But we know later from Jesus' appearances, post-resurrection appearances, that the stone was no problem. Jesus didn't need to, he did not need to move the stone to get out. The stone was removed so we could get in. That's why. And also the angel. Now this is really cool, I think, when you think about at least this implication. The angel was there for the women. I mean, his job was done as far as that part. But he's there for the women. Now, this is very important. I don't want you to under or devalue this part of the account of the resurrection. Because in the century, it was understood, especially among Jews, that a woman's testimony was unreliable. Now, if you don't like that, I'm sorry. That's just the way the culture was. The only way that a woman's testimony carried any kind of significance is if her husband or her father stood behind her affirming what she was saying to be true. Otherwise, women's testimony was not readily embraced. And you're going to see that their disciples, they responded to the women like, "You're just an emotional woman. What you're saying can't be true. You're not logical in your thinking. You're taken with all of your emotion here." They don't believe them. They don't believe them. It's kind of funny, like the story of sweet little Rhoda in the book of Acts. When Peter is released, the angel, you know, takes him out of the prison, and he's there knocking on the gate trying to get in. Rhoda recognizes his voice. She goes in and tells him that Peter's here. They told her, "You're wrong. Don't you know we're praying for him? He's in jail. Well, they don't believe her. Bless her heart. But she was right. Now, I tell you that for a very important reason. And I want you to hear it. If you're making this stuff up, you would never begin with the first people that the resurrected Jesus appears to be women. But you just wouldn't do that. You know why you wouldn't do that? Because it's a detail, it's a contradiction to the story. Well, how could you believe, if it was real, why would he appear to women first? Matter of fact, in Paul's recollection, and when he's talking about it in 1 Corinthians 11, I believe, in 1 Corinthians 11, he points out there that he appeared first. You know, it talks about to Peter and the other apostles, and one later to me, and then to 500 at one time. He doesn't even mention the women being first. But all four Gospels in agreement say, who were the first to see the resurrected Christ? The women. You would never include a detail like that unless it were true. And if you're making this up, that's a convenient detail to leave out. Because future, when Jewish men would be told that Jesus rose from the dead and the first witnesses were women, they would begin scoffing. I hope you understand that. You see, Gary Habermas, a scholar that has written tons of material, and matter of fact, he's doing a four-volume, you know, his magnus opus about the resurrection. He's been an authority on the resurrection for years and years and years. If you want to know something about all the history and all the details about the resurrection, read Habermas. Matter of fact, he kind of jokingly said in an interview that his students have learned that if they don't know the answer to a question, if they write resurrection, they get half credit, regardless of the question. That's tongue in cheek, of course. But he came up with what he called the four universally agreed upon evidences that surround the resurrection. Four. Doesn't matter if the scholar is a liberal or an atheist or anything. There are four facts that are agreed upon by all scholars, regardless of their stripe. Number one, Jesus died on a cross during the days of Pilate, as Pilate ruled ancient Israel, Palestine. He was crucified during that time. He was buried in a borrowed tomb that was owned by Joseph of Arimathea. Also, that he was The tomb was found empty 3 days following his death. The tomb was empty. That's the third one. And the fourth one is what he calls the post-mortem appearances. That he was seen and believed to be alive by his followers. Okay, those four things are historical verified facts. Now you have to try to explain those. You've got to satisfactorily explain all four of those to give an alternate theory. And no one can. They might hit one or two. Maybe if it's a real good theory, maybe three, but they can't get all four. Well, you can satisfy all four of those statements or those facts. So anyway, he's found to be alive by a group of his women followers. The number of women that are mentioned, it varies. But just because it varies does not mean that the account is somehow contradictory. It just means that certain people are mentioned and others are suggested. They may have been there, but they're just not named. And that just, you know, that there's nothing wrong with that. We do that kind of thing all the time. You go somewhere, well, who'd you see? Well, so-and-so is there and so-and-so is there. Is that the only two people there? No, there were a lot of other people there, and you name them too. But you just name the two that you think of offhand. Okay, let's go a bit further. And as they went to tell his disciples, behold, Jesus met them, saying, rejoice. So they came and held him by his feet and worshipped him. And Jesus said to them, do not be afraid. Go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee, and there they will see me. Okay? So they see him alive. Not only do they see him alive, they feel that he's alive. He's not a ghost. Not a phantasm or anything like that. He's actually physically there because they grab a hold of his feet. They're worshiping him. And he tells them, he gives them a mission. Go tell the brothers that I'm going ahead to Galilee, and there they will see me. Following that, we got to deal with the soldiers. Now, while they were going, behold, some of the guard came into the city and reported the chief priests and all the things that had happened. When they had assembled the elders and consulted together, they gave a large sum of money to the soldiers, saying, tell them his disciples came at night and stole him away while we slept. Now, this is very hastily come up with. Very hastily come up with. And if this comes to the governor's ears, we will appease him and make you secure. Why? Well, because if it comes to the governor's ears that they were sleeping while they were supposed to be guarding, it would mean death. So they're promising. They bribe them, say, with a significant amount of money. They tell them, we'll protect you. Just tell this story. So they took the money and did as they were instructed. And this saying is commonly reported among the Jews until this day. I'm glad that's the explanation they came up with. Because it doesn't take very long for you to figure out that is, the Greek word for it is baloney. Really? Well, think about it. Number one. Would they have been sleeping on duty? Well, no, they would not have been, but say they were. Maybe they were really tired. Maybe they hadn't slept for 3 or 4 days, and they fell asleep at their post. Oh, okay. Well, here's the problem. Here's the problem. When you're asleep, are you aware of what's going on around you? Anybody? No. You don't know what's going on. You can have a lot of fun with people when they're asleep. Not that I ever did, but you really can have a very entertaining time when you're dealing with people who are asleep. Now, so if they were asleep, how would they have known? How would they have known that the disciples came and stole the body while they slept. That's the first part.
Who else would have?
Huh?
Their response would be, who else would steal their body? Disciples would be the only logical choice.
Right, right. That's the first possibility. But you know, what I'm saying is, it's illogical. Somebody who's asleep is not aware of what's going on around them unless they wake up. Here's the second thing. Remember the stone. The stone. How are you going to move that quietly while a group of guards are asleep?
Yeah.
How are you going to do that? I don't know. Have you ever tried to move something that's really, really heavy?
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be a groan that you're going to make. It's hard to be quiet. Especially moving a big rock that's going to make a lot of racket. You know, what I'm saying by this is, it's so hurriedly offered that it's illogical we might even consider it to be a possibility. It just did not happen. It could not have happened. But that's the explanation that is given for what did happen. Now, the explanation proves something. What does the explanation prove?
Guards were liars.
The tomb is empty. The tomb is empty.
Jesus.
You know. You've got to explain that. How is the tomb empty? The tomb is empty because they stole the body, you see. That's the way of trying to deal with it. So that acknowledges. Now, these are Jesus' adversaries. All they would have had to have done is one simple thing. Produce the body. That's all you got to do. Produce the body. If they could have produced the body, there would have been no Christianity at all. The reason why they couldn't produce the body is because there was no body in there to produce. He had risen from the dead. Now we move on to the next section. It's a very familiar section. That is what we usually call or refer to as the Great Commission. Before I go there, any comments about what we've covered so far?
Seems interesting that his enemies recognized his promise more than his disciples seem to have recognized it.
Yeah.
We're going to have to do something because he promised, and if there's a lie being circulated, we're in trouble. So we got to do something to take care of that need. The disciples didn't seem to even be thinking in those terms, but they were.
No, that's right. That's right. Yes.
Did you go to the tomb when
in
Israel? Now, what pictures, as I remember, you stepped down to it, right? Or is it?
Well, matter of fact, it's on my Facebook. A picture of Tara and I sitting right in front of it. We got a picture on the inside. Now, that is a first century type tomb. It's probably not the tomb that Jesus was actually in. But it helps you understand what it would have looked like. It is a tomb hewn into the rock. It is a hewn tomb, so it's been dug out or chiseled out. And what it is there are, it's in a garden. What we've today, of course, it's got plants all around and that kind of thing. And you go up to it, and there's two steps up going into it. The doorway itself is quite small. You have to duck down or you're going to smack your head on it, on the rock when you go in. But when you step inside, to your immediate right is that area carved out for a body to lay on. And then on over, there's another spot. Now, there's a metal fence right there, so you can't get over to it. You just go in, you can look around, take a few pictures and that kind of thing. So, yeah, I saw that. The actual tomb probably is where the Roman Catholic Church, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is. But one of the later Roman Caesars, I forgot which one, trashed the whole area of where the tomb actually probably was they tore it up, caved it in, do all that kind of stuff. Later in history, there was a Roman Catholic church built on top of that vicinity, which is, you know, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre there. No one knows for certain, but most likely that's the place. The Garden Tomb today is a representative of what that tomb could have looked like. And it fits the description that it was close to the crucifixion site. It wasn't far away. It was a garden, not a garden like you and I think of a garden, but an area there. It actually, the one that has the Garden Tomb now, it actually has a vat where they crush grapes, you know, to get the juice out of them. There's actually one of those there. And there's actually a first century stone there where that would have been used to cover a tomb's opening. So that's something, you know, about that. When you get to the Great Commission, of course, you're familiar with this. This is nothing that you're not keenly aware of. It says, the 11 disciples went away into Galilee to a mountain which Jesus had appointed for them. When they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. Notice, again, I was talking to you a while ago about there are certain kind of facts or certain kind of statements that you can talk about being the embarrassment factor. The one embarrassment factor is that it's not the men disciples, it's the female disciples that are the first to see the resurrected Christ. That's embarrassing. That's called the embarrassment factor. If it's not true, it would not have been mentioned there. There's a second embarrassment factor, and it's right here, where it says, they worshipped him, but some doubted. Do you doubt your eyes? Yeah. Do you doubt what you're hearing? Yeah. How can this be? They're trying to wrap their mind around what they're witnessing. And some doubted. That also would be considered an embarrassment factor. And I've talked to you about this before. Normally what people do is they leave out embarrassing details in recounting an event. They just do. And I told you about my good friend from Arkansas named Vernon, didn't I? If not, indulge me, because he's a good example of what I'm talking about. Vernon, early in my first wedding in Arkansas, Vernon married a gal named Kathy. Kathy and Vernon had all kinds of baggage. I mean, all kinds of baggage. And then so did Kathy, but they thought they were going to get married. And all right, they got married. And when I married them, I wasn't legally able to marry them, which is another story. I got the marriage license. He hands it to me. We go through, you know, it's just a very, very small get-together. And I'm filling it out, and I go, what? It had a place on there that I had to be registered in. Of course, it's Deschutes County, and I had to write down the book page number that I'm registered in to perform weddings. They made them on Friday night. The courthouse is not open tomorrow, so I sweat all weekend. First thing Monday morning, I'm calling the lady in the clerk's office. Just laughed real big. Said, "Hey, no problem. Well, bring your ordination and license down and show it to me sometime, you know, today. I'm just going to post-date this." So I'll write it in there, and I've got it written in one of my old marriage books, that I'm on page such and such a line. That's my credentials. Anyway, but later they started having, of course they got baggage, remember? Well, they started having issues. And Vernon comes to him and he talks about this woman that he married. Kind of blaming me for it, but I don't know. And so he's telling me all about this and this and this and this. I go, oh my goodness, Vernon. I'm green. I'm gullible. I didn't realize he was leaving out certain details. And then I said, well, Vernon, you and Kathy, I need to get you both together and talk to you and see if we can work through some of this stuff. And I didn't know what to do. I don't know. So anyway, I thought pastors were supposed to do that, so I got them there, and they were sitting across the desk from me, and we start talking. And then Vernon says a thing or two, and then Kathy begins talking. And I go, oh, really? Coming, and Vernon, I kid you not, 10, 15 minutes into our conversation, he gets up, he's mad, he stomps out, he leaves. And I realized right then, you know, I never got the full story. The thing of it was, Vernon was leaving out those details that are embarrassing. They kind of leaving those out. And I tell you what, that's just what people do. All right. So when you have these kind of details, you realize, that's embarrassing. Therefore, undoubtedly it's true, because people don't do that. And they don't write that down either. You know, Peter denying Christ three times. You don't include that. He's the hero, you know. But no. Anyway, the Great Commission. And the disciples, but some doubted. And Jesus came and spoke to them, saying, all authority. How much authority? All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. Go, therefore, and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I have commanded you, and lo, I'm with you always, even to the end of the age. Or the end of the world. It can be translated either way. Very succinctly there, you have a Trinitarian statement. Pay attention to words, because it's important. Name is singular. Father, Son, and Spirit follow. That's a Trinitarian statement. We are to reach. We are to teach the people. That's the idea of discipleship. Reaching them, we are to go and reach and all nations, people groups, all kinds of people groups. Questions or comments?
So how do you do Pentecostal?
You're talking about the one, it's not all Pentecostal. This is the United oneness. Pentecostal or the Oneness Pentecostals. Apostolic sometimes are also oneness. It bugs them, to be sure. But later in the book of Acts, you have Luke recording, and they baptized them in the name of Jesus, which is probably just an abbreviation. He didn't list all three of the Godhead, Father, Son, and Spirit there. But they do a lot to ignore those kind of things. And then they focus on passages that seem to support what they're saying. That's what everybody does. Heretics do, is that they focus on those things that seemingly support their case and ignore those things that seemingly does not support their case. So, yeah. See, what Oneness Pentecostals believe is an ancient heresy called modalism. The basic idea is God the Father in the Old Testament, in the Gospels, you have the same person, but now manifested as Jesus. And then you have, in the epistles, you have the Holy Spirit, but it's the same person as before. And that was a very difficult battle for years for Christians to come up with a proper understanding of how to deal with who Jesus is. Because there was a lot of heresies that were everywhere in the ancient world trying to describe him. And it was only later that it was nailed down. Real quickly, and then I'll let you go. Because the Trinity is very important. Very important indeed. All right. Basically, you have you have God. God is the being that is God. is composed of or exists as three persons. All right? It's one what, three whos. That is not a logical contradiction. If I say that the person who is God is composed of three persons, that's a logical contradiction. You can't have one and three like that. It's just not, it's not logical. And even God can't be illogical. That may strike you as odd, but he can't. He can't be a square circle. Can God create a square circle?
No.
No, he can't. Because a square has certain properties and a circle certain properties. You can't create a square circle. Anyway, so what you have here, you have the being that is God, is Father, it's three persons, Father, Son, and Spirit. All three are equal. Equal in power, equal in the same essence, meaning that Jesus is not inferior to the Father in any way, even though he does subordinate himself to the Father. But he's not, he is the eternal God himself. John tells us that you know, when he begins, that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And when you get down to verse 14, you know what the Word is. It's referring to Jesus. All things came into being through him. Without him, nothing that exists came into being that has come into being. In other words, in Genesis chapter 1, who's doing the creating? Jesus. And in Colossians, you have that very high view of Jesus as well. In him, the fullness of God was pleased to dwell. Think about that. It's kind of sometimes difficult for us. So, but the Father is not the Son. The Son is not the Spirit. The Spirit is not the Father. But all three persons are one God. And that may, if that makes your head swim a little bit, that's good. Because if I could fully explain this, I would be, I'd have an understanding like God, and I don't. So it is okay to be uncomfortable. Like, I just don't quite get that. Good. That means God is far greater than you and I can ever imagine. And it has implications for so much. Okay? You may have more questions about that, but remember, the Father is not the Spirit. The Father is not the Son. Now the one as Pentecostals would say, the Father and the Son and the Spirit are all the same God. In other words, he just reveals himself in those three different ways. But it's just one being, God. Okay? That just doesn't work. It doesn't work biblically. Okay? All right. Good deal. You are free to roam. We are finished with Matthew.